He's been called the startup whisperer of Silicon Valley. Reid Hoffman is the co-founder and executive chairman of LinkedIn and an investor in some of the most successful companies of all time, including Facebook. Yet the man with one of the most impressive resumes in Silicon Valley wasn't always on track to be an entrepreneur. A student of philosophy, Hoffman at one point pursued a career in academia. But he took his first job out of school at Apple, then later joined the now legendary PayPal Mafia. Now a partner at Greylock, Hoffman sits on 7 boards. He's the author of The Startup of You and now a new book, The Alliance. Our guest today on Studio 1.0 is Reid Hoffman.
Great Reid,
thank you
here.
So much for joining us.
My pleasure.
So you have no shortage of jobs to do. Why did you write this book?
The key thing is, in many circumstances, companies, employers and employees are lying to each other. Because the notion is the modern career is actually, in fact, changing, where there's options for shifting companies, for how do you evolve, even career tracks are changing. So the question is, how do you get that investment in the future and that entrepreneurial relationship between the company, the employer, and the employee? And the short answer is alliance. And it's an alliance that's based on tours of duty, where you set up for a project that's like 3 or 5 years long, and that transforms your career, makes you employable, and transforms the company.
You say people should be honest from the start. How honest should they be?
Well, to give you an example of something that I learned from one of our executives at LinkedIn, Kevin Scott, who's the head of operations and engineering, when he's interviewing people, before they've started the company, he asks them what job they want after LinkedIn. That's actually part of his interviewing.
So what do you want to do next after
yes.
you do this?
Yes, and that's a level of transparency, and we're committed to your career. We want your stint here to be transformative to what your career is.
What if you hear something you don't like?
Well, then you ask why. But by the way, that's a very good thing to learn. So if you learn something, you're like, oh, wait a minute, actually, that may mean that our alliance over this tour of duty, over this 3 to 5 years, may not work.
This comparison to the military, the term tour of duty, do people really feel that way about their companies, that patriotic as a soldier is to his country?
We so much wanted to get people to understand is like, look, it's not daily employment. And it is an investment in something real, and it should be transformative, that a kind of a bold term would be the right way for people to think about it.
What other companies out there are doing this well?
So,
you have your hand in so many of them.
Google, for example, when I talked to Eric Schmidt, it's like, no, actually, we normally think about these as 3 to 5 year, they weren't using the word tour of duty, but like 3 to 5 year stints where the person actually learns a job, achieves something significant, proves themselves into the job, and then goes on to do something else. eBay focuses a lot on how do we bring the relationships of all the folks who have graduated from eBay and PayPal together and have the external network tied in. But even, for example, places like GE, right, in terms of what they used to do and they still do for executive rotation, but also how do you then groom all kinds of stars to be a executive at this, you know, huge industrial conglomerate.
What does Silicon Valley get that other industries don't yet?
Silicon Valley understands that R&D is not just like we hole up in our lab and we invent something and then, you know, then ta-da, there it is. That actually being present and active in what's going on in the entire network around Silicon Valley is central to innovation. So people frequently, for example, hold up Steve Jobs as, well, he was the guy sitting in the back room and invent something. They didn't realize he was talking to people constantly. He was like, what could be done here? What's here? I'm interested in learning about this. You know, I want to learn about what these Google folks are doing. Let me talk to them. And so Silicon Valley is a combination of intense competition and intense cooperation.
LinkedIn sits at an interesting paradox because on the one hand, it makes it easier for people to find good opportunities. It also makes it easier for companies to lose good people.
When you have a more open and transparent ecosystem, that means that the quality opportunities, the quality companies, the high culture companies will benefit because essentially the talent will flow to that. But overall, it creates massive benefit both for the individuals and for the companies that have interesting opportunities. And that's a good thing.
You have a statement of alliance at the end of the book that people can use as a guide. In the end, though, isn't it just a promise? And a promise can be broken.
Promises can be broken, just like any relationships. And so, you know, sometimes you like a friendship ends and that kind of thing. It happens. But if you lived your whole life like, oh, friendships may end, so I'm not going to have any friends, that would be terrible.
So many companies have a founding myth that's sort of boiled down into legend. What is the myth of Reid Hoffman and what's the reality?
Myth, reality, who can tell the difference? The myth is kind of a manifest destiny march towards entrepreneurship and technology. And the reality is kind of an instinct for how do we come together as people and what are the ways to help that? And oh, look, software. Oh, look, entrepreneurship, right? As ways of discovering that path. And that's kind of the myth and reality.
Let's take a break. We'll be right back. Let's talk about how you got there. You grew up in Berkeley.
Yep.
What'd your parents do?
Oh, both parents are lawyers. That led to, because the legal profession is the one that people most often leave when you actually look at the actuarial charts on people transitioning. So when people asked me in 12 what I wanted to be when I grew up, the answer was not a lawyer.
What was the answer?
I actually didn't know. What happened is I kind of got the independence bug a little early. I was going to a school that was on the Berkeley-Oakland border called the College Preparatory School, and I was like, and a friend of mine said, oh, I'm going to the school called the Putney School, and it's in Vermont. And I was like, wait, I could go and be independent and be exploring my own life. So I applied for and got into the Putney School without either of my parents knowing.
You applied to boarding school without your parents knowing.
Yes. Because it was kind of the independent streak, which I encountered a little early.
What kid were you in high school? Did you fit into one of the boxes anywhere?
No, actually, I was a pretty strange individualist. So, like, for example, I usually would have one or two friends in most of the different cliques. Like, I had a friend or two out of the jocks, and a friend or two out of the artists, and a friend or two, and it was all very individual. I did have, much younger, I was part of the fantasy role-playing group. Right,
so what is that?
So Dungeons and Dragons.
Okay.
Right. So when I was, and actually the way I got into Dungeons and Dragons is my dad, when I was 9, hired a babysitter for me, who introduced me to Dungeons and Dragons, and I was like, oh, creating new worlds and thinking about how stories come together and kind of like an interactive novel.
So you went to Stanford.
Yes.
You majored in symbolic systems. Marissa Meyer also majored in symbolic systems. What is that?
So symbolic systems, it's a unique major to Stanford, and it's the simple explanation is cognitive science and artificial intelligence, although most people will think that isn't simple. But really, it's actually a step deeper, which is part of what's transforming the world are these notions of systems of symbols, whether they're computer programs, whether it's mathematics and logic, whether it's models of how we think and psychology. And I think I was the 8th or 9th person to declare the major, yes.
So while you were at Stanford, you met Peter Thiel.
Yes.
Tell me how you met.
So Peter and I had both been told about each other by people we knew. I wasn't told that there was this really right-wing person. He was told there was this really left-wing person. We both went, wait a minute, I've heard about you. And so we grabbed coffee, and I think we argued for 8 hours, right? Because we're like, oh, you can't believe that. And then we're like, that was fun. Let's do that again.
You went on to Oxford. You studied philosophy.
Yes.
Why?
It was like, well, I think I'll be an academic. Because if I'm an academic, I can write about both these interesting questions. I'm always fascinated about people, how we think, how we reason, how we communicate. And in fact, actually, what I realized was that the course of becoming an academic professor was to be a very, very narrow scholar. And so you essentially wanted to be an expert on this thing that, say, for example, only 10 to 20 people in the world probably knew about. And actually what I really want to do is how do you help millions of people? Basically within about 6 months at Oxford, I knew that actually, in fact, I wasn't going to be an academic. I was going to come back here and...
So that's when you decided to be an entrepreneur,
well,
essentially.
Well, that's when I started to work on software. Actually, in fact, thinking of myself as an entrepreneur, that kind of came later.
So you took your first job at Apple.
Yes.
1994, sort of in the middle of the near-death spiral.
Yes.
Did you meet Steve Jobs at that
time? No, Steve Jobs wasn't there at the time.
Okay.
I was literally at Apple at the, we don't know what we're doing. We have no really good plan to adapt to what's going on in the future. I went there because I loved Apple products. Mm-hmm. I love the Macintosh. I bought one of the earliest ones. I learned to program on the Apple IIe. Mm-hmm.
Then you went out on to start your own company.
Yeah.
You started a social network sort of before social networks, right? It was called SocialNet?
It was called SocialNet.
1997?
Yes. SocialNet had some of the right ideas. It had the idea of having a profile. It had the idea of discoverability. It had the idea of having some kind of social controls on the how you would meet strangers. But it didn't have the fundamental network idea. It didn't have the fundamental real identity idea.
You then went on to the PayPal
Yes.
mafia. Who called who? How did that end? How did that happen?
I called Peter, and Peter said, "Oh, well, we're gonna actually probably gonna sell PayPal because we don't have a business model at the time. But it would be really useful for us because you know all this stuff. Could you help us come organize the company and help sell it and everything else?" And I said, "Well, actually, I know all you guys, and you know, look, if that'd be helpful, I'd be happy to step in and do that." And of course, we didn't end up selling the company. We ended up taking it public, selling it to eBay after we took it public. And so, you know, what was supposed to be a 6-month tour of duty turned into a 3-year tour of duty, and the PayPal story is long and fun.
And legend. When did it start being called the Mafia?
You know, I don't really know. It might have been with the Fortune article. Oh. I'm always a little hesitant about the term because it's like mafia implies dark room, you know, extortionate practices, you know, these kinds of things. It's clever. It gets repeated. It implies a very dense and tight network where people are really tight with each other. For example, if I were to call it, it's probably much less evocative, but like the PayPal network would be the way I would call it. I think it's probably started 6 to 12 months after the eBay acquisition.
LinkedIn, Tesla, YouTube, Yelp, Yammer, and SpaceX, all founded by members of the PayPal Mafia. Yep. What was special about all of you? What did you have in common?
PayPal collected a whole bunch of people who were young and intense and were entrepreneurial themselves. And then all of a sudden, it was bought by eBay. So a bunch of these folks are like, okay, well, what do I do next? And so, you know, Chad and Steve go and do YouTube, and Elon goes and does Tesla and SpaceX, and Jeremy and Russ do Yelp, and you know, I do LinkedIn, and yet, because we've had this intense experience together, we all have still really tight network, and so we're all calling each other going, hey, I'm thinking about doing this, what do you think?
Who do you call for what?
So for example, macroeconomic, financial, bold models, I'll call Peter. The intersection of kind of interesting business models or business technologies, things like big data, Max Levchin, for a willingness to just think super big with risk is not a variable, Elon, right?
What do they call you for?
Laughs, no.
I've heard you're quite funny.
Occasionally, but I don't know, the other people are funnier. A view of the valley. Like, okay, I'm thinking about X, who are the right people to talk to about X?
You were instrumental in the sale to eBay for $1.5 billion, 2002. Looking back, was it the right decision? I mean, eBay, PayPal have had an interesting year. Some other members of the PayPal Mafia think they're better apart.
Yeah. It was absolutely the right decision at the time, and we made it collaboratively. And part of the reason was because to really get to the right kind of level of mass of the payments transaction system, it required a much closer connection with eBay. Now that it's gotten to a certain level, you can say, look, is it better inside or outside? And one can make good arguments both ways. The argument with is, for example, well, actually, in fact, there's still a lot of density of value between eBay and PayPal. On the other hand, the argument against it is say, well, actually, in fact, you know, maybe PayPal should become a bank. eBay is not a bank holding company. And the natural evolution is to head there in some direction. And that's also possible with the right management team.
It's time for another quick break. We'll be right back. After you sold PayPal, you could have retired a few times over, probably. Some other members of the PayPal Mafia bought Ferraris. You bought an Acura, which is still a very nice car. But you didn't say, look, I'm just going to lean back.
First, a little funny story on the car. I was thinking about buying an Audi S8 because we're like, well, you know, it's a really nice car and so forth. And then what happened is I got pitched by a friend of mine on investing in a startup. I was like, well, will I rather buy the S8? Or would I rather invest in the startup? So I was like, okay, what's the cheapest nice car that I could buy? Because I would actually rather spend my money investing in these companies that are transforming the world. And so that's how I ended up buying the Acura.
And then you decided to start something new.
I was thinking about taking a year off. I was thinking about traveling around the world for a year. And what I realized was in 2002, Silicon Valley basically concluded the internet was over. And I was like, no, it's just beginning. And the current companies are great, Google, Yahoo, eBay, Amazon. But there are only going to be some of the great companies going to be created. As opposed to a year, I took 2 weeks in Australia, came back, said, okay, what's my best idea? Oh, look, LinkedIn is actually still a very valid idea. The market opportunity is ripe for it. I should start that. Started investing in companies like Facebook and Flickr and a number of others. And I was like, let's just go all in on this next generation of internet.
I know the early years were hard. Tell me about that.
So I don't know how many of our viewers will remember this, but Friendster was all the rage back then.
I remember Friendster.
And so what happened is I'd come and say, oh, this is what LinkedIn is. And they say, well, you're like Friendster, but for business. And I was like, well, no, that's not the way I would describe it. But I mean, I can't tell you the number of times I've had conversations with people who, you know, who are smart and very close to say, this isn't gonna work. And I'm like, I think it will, so.
When did you come closest to giving up?
Oh, never.
Ever?
Never, no.
It took 5 years to turn a profit, and you made some really hard decisions along the way, including stepping down as CEO and becoming executive chairman.
The question really wasn't like, oh, is it a difficult thing for ego, for stepping down as CEO, as much as what gives us the best possible chance to realize something? And part of what I'd come to realize was that I'm passionate about scale impact in the world. I'm passionate about solving product and business problems. I'm passionate about entrepreneurship and innovation, but I'm not passionate about running an organization. Like, I don't wake up going, how do I run my exec staff better? And how do I, when we're onboarding the next 100 people, how do we do that in a really good way? And I know it's important, but it's not the problem that I wake up thinking about. As it came together with Jeff, and Jeff said, look, I can help you kind of first as an interim kind of running the kind of the exec stuff, the stuff that you are kind of feel challenged about. And then we're like, oh, but actually Jeff's enough of a product guy. He can actually do this job.
Tell me a little bit about your partnership with Jeff.
Jeff and I get along very well. For example, Jeff knows that when it comes down to things like building organizational cultures or thinking about how do you really make an executive staff work really well together and how do you identify A-plus talent through the whole organization. So we partner on these things together and we solve these problems together.
So you split your time now between LinkedIn and Greylock. Hmm. How do you split your time? I mean, is it like 50-50? Can you break it down?
Or 70-70?
It's probably more like
yes,
that.
You know, so I, generally speaking, work 7 days a week. I have an office right next to Jeff's. The short answer is all.
And 7 days a week?
Yes.
You've had so many wins already. Why do you do all of this?
The way I think about it is, how do you have a life that you were proud about having lived it? That you think that what you did in the world was worth it?
You think about Steve Jobs at Apple, Mark Zuckerberg at Facebook, Larry and Sergey at Google. Is there a magic that a founder brings that would be lost if you weren't here?
I think so. Every founder is useful because of that vision, the commitment, the willingness to take bold risks.
You joined Greylock as a partner in 2009, and you have a really unique investing philosophy in that the best companies to invest in are actually the companies you don't agree on.
Most people think that the way that a venture partnership works is everyone votes to do a deal, and then when everyone says, yes, this is a good deal, then that's the deal that happens. However, the best deals are not all where everyone's voting, yes, I would do the deal too. The really bold deals that transform industries are the ones that initially seem a little crazy, a little out there, not quite right, like LinkedIn in its early days, and yet end up growing to something that's big.
Didn't you guys disagree on Facebook and Airbnb?
Yes, there was disagreements in the partnership. Matter of fact, our partner, not to be named, said this is going to be the death of Greylock. And with Airbnb, a variety of the partners, including David Z, said, you know, like, people really going to rent out their rooms? And isn't that going to be a little weird? He and I had an argument. He said, fine, I wouldn't do the deal, but you can. And obviously, you know, Airbnb is doing great.
You've been called the startup whisperer of Silicon Valley. What is whispering to startups involved?
Well, I'm not quite sure. I guess what people who use that term, I don't identify myself that way, by being an entrepreneur myself, by being a participant in a lot of the early stage companies. And it's not that I know everything, but I know some things that are useful.
We live in an age of four increasingly powerful platforms, Apple, Google, Facebook, and Amazon. Do you worry at all that any one of them could become too powerful?
Yes, although not necessarily specifically each one of them, but more as a general system. But naturally, when you have aggregation of platforms, you have to worry about leaving room for entrepreneurs, leaving room for innovation. And so I worry about that on a general basis, not on those specific four companies basis, because I've talked to all the, you know, the CEOs of those companies, and you know, they're all like, look, we're just trying to build really great products and do great things.
Richard Branson has a private island. Steve Ballmer is buying a sports team. Mark Benioff gives a lot away. What do you do with all the money you've made?
Most of it's still in LinkedIn stock because I'm building the world through LinkedIn. I serve on a number of different nonprofit boards like Kiva and Endeavor and Do Something. I try to finance projects that I think are interesting.
Are we ever going to see you start something else? Another company?
Probably not. With Series A and seed founders, I work pretty closely with them. There's a long way to go with LinkedIn still. So I'd say it's unlikely, although you will see me partnering with a bunch of great young entrepreneurs and trying to help figure out how to build something big.
Reid Hoffman, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure
Thank you.
To have you on the show.